on this episode of Optimal Health Uncovered.
So if we're really stressed out, we might resort to behaviors that we don't typically do day to day, like eating way too much or smoking or drinking or not getting your physical activity. So ironically, those are all things that can help ease our stress and keep us healthy and help with our cardiovascular system. And when we're feeling stressed, we do those, or we might do those types of behaviors that are actually hurting us. So recognizing how our stress manifests itself in certain behaviors can be one step to increase your awareness and how to gain a little bit more control over that.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Optimal Health Uncovered. My name is Brendan Copley.
And I'm Ariana Martinetti.
And today we're going to be talking about the effects of stress on cardiac health. So my role at Performance is a personal trainer and an athletic trainer.
And I am the mental performance consultant here at Performance Optimal Health.
So my own intention for this podcast is to be able to shed light a little bit more on the actionable steps that you can do to reduce your stress in order to improve your cardiovascular health, and also create a little bit more of a definition of how stress actually impacts your cardiovascular health, and then also what abnormal and normal cardiovascular health is.
And in conjunction with that, I hope to provide some education on stress so that you're able to apply it to your own context in order to increase your ability in managing it or having some more control over it and seeing how that affects your cardiovascular health and well-being.
Awesome. So with that said, let's jump right in. I think a good starting point for this is to really go in and delve into just establishing what both a healthy and what an abnormal cardiovascular system is, because I think that sets the framework of how stress impacts it and some of the other things that we'll talk about moving forward.
For sure.
So in order to define just what is a healthy cardiovascular system, I think we can look at it as the heart and the blood vessels are going to be effectively providing a continuous supply of oxygen and nutrients from your blood while simultaneously getting rid of carbon dioxide and other waste.
Yep.
And then in an abnormal functioning cardiovascular system, this is going to be there's some sort of disease or disconnect of the heart musculature, blood vessels, conduction rate, or structure of the heart itself. Like you have some sort of congenital heart defect, things like that. Mm-hmm. And this is then leading to a disruption in the circulation of nutrients and waste to the body.
Yeah. Thanks for defining that. And in terms of stress, which can affect our cardiovascular health, stress is our mental and bodily responses to some sort of environmental demand that we're experiencing. And it's a reaction that contributes to us being in a particular state, which can either be short-term or long-term. And sometimes stress can be helpful because it allows us to adjust or adapt to something that might be putting us in danger. And other times it can feel like it's taking over and affecting our day-to-day life. So while it's normal to experience stress and we all experience it differently, it's important to recognize how that might be affecting us.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then from there, I guess, how might someone experience some of these different types of stress that you're mentioning?
Yeah, well, the first step would be recognizing that we all experience particular demands. And for example, you and I are both on a podcast right now. We're in the same situation, and I might be perceiving this as intimidating or anxiety provoking or nerve wracking. And you could be perceiving this as exciting and you're feeling confident and you're feeling ready. So the biggest difference between you and I being in the same situation is how we're perceiving it.
Gotcha. And let's be clear here. I think I'm still a little bit nervous about hosting a podcast. So let's get our story straight.
And with that said, what comes after the way that we perceive certain demands that we're in is our bodily responses. So if you and I are feeling anxious, then we might be experiencing butterflies in our stomach or sweaty palms, increased heart rate, muscle tension. And in my work with athletes, when they're placed in particular situations that they perceive to be threatening or challenging, then they're experiencing all those sorts of things, which can then end up hurting their performance because the way that we're physiologically feeling can contribute to what our behaviors are while we're in that stressed out state. So where my work comes in is addressing what those perceptions are to certain situations or demands that are placed on the athlete in order to then mitigate them, whether it's their self-talk or their beliefs, in order to then lower the other physiological or psychological things that they're experiencing, like worry and things of that sort. And then for individuals that are going to work or just, you know, going through stressful things with their families, while they're placed in certain situations, they're perceiving those particular demands, which then contributes to the stress that they're feeling.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I'm always fascinated by how athletics and using how our mind interacts with the performance anxiety of athletics, or how we're trying to get the best out of a certain sport, how that then is oftentimes extrapolated into how we work with the rest of our daily life and things like that. So it seems like there's so much crossover between those two fields.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially when you think of it from the perspective of overall stress and how that contributes to our anxiety and activation levels, which we experience activation and anxiety in all facets of our life. Yeah, good point.
Yeah, that totally makes me think of the statement that's in a lot of like baseball or tennis based scenarios. That's pressure builds diamonds. Which, you know, kind of goes to show if you expose yourself to kind of high pressure situations and if you're building up your resiliency with those types of situations and you have a good framework, a good way of kind of working through those like higher stress situations, you can get better and better and better at it if you're matching your kind of daily practices with the amount of stress that you're actually being exposed to.
Yeah. And you're bringing up a great point, which is how are you perceiving that pressure, or how is the individual handling it? Do they see it as a challenge and they're ready to take it on, or do they see it as a threat and it's sort of breaking them down? So going back to how each person decides to view that pressure and then what it ends up doing to them. So you're spot on.
Yeah. So I think we talked a little bit about this, but I'd love to break it down a little bit more. Can we chat on how specifically stress is going to then affect your cardiovascular system? What is the science behind what's happening within your body in order to make that happen?
Yeah. So when we are in a stress state or we're perceiving many things to be stressful, then we are activating our sympathetic nervous system. And our sympathetic nervous system is part of our autonomic nervous system. And that is responsible for our homeostasis. It allows us to have automatic and involuntary types of responses. So our sympathetic nervous system is more of our fight or flight response. It puts us on alert. It activates other parts of our body. And in contrast, our parasympathetic nervous system is what calms us down, regulates us, regulates our digestion, brings our heart rate back to normal. So it's more of our rest
and digest.
So when we are experiencing stressors and activating our sympathetic nervous system and have more of this continual activation of it, it ends up keeping us on alert. It can contribute to hypertension, reduced heart rate variability, and those types of reactions can affect our brain functioning, our hormones, and our immune system. But with that said, I also want to acknowledge that sometimes this activation of our sympathetic nervous system could be helpful for our heart in instances like exercise, which I think you could speak more to, and how that can activate us and get us ready for physical activity.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So in your line of work too, when you're working with a patient, what are some of the things that you're doing that might be specifically trying to influence this concept of trying to get them better at being able to bring themselves from this more sympathetic state into a more parasympathetic state potentially?
Yeah, good question. And for most athletes, it comes down to what they perceive their best activation level for performance to be. So sometimes athletes will say that they have a better performance when they have either moderate levels of activation or higher levels of activation. And that can come in the form of not necessarily worry, but if they are having higher cognitive self-talk. So if they're more hyping themselves up or giving themselves what they need in order to be ready versus someone that might perform better with lower activation levels. So they need to feel like they're a little bit more calm in order to prepare better. And for those that like those higher activation levels, they can utilize that energy as a way that they care about what they're doing. So the first step is really identifying if athletes feel like they perform with lower, moderate, or higher levels of activation. And then recognizing when they're out of their zones and then getting them back into the particular zone, whether it's through breathing exercises or self-talk or brief imagery or even pre-performance routines that they might get for themselves or
That's
make
awesome.
For themselves.
So, and I could kind of picture too how that would work more in the workplace environment or just throughout your daily life. So for example, if I have a new client and I'm a little bit nervous about just working with someone new, whatever it may be, there's always a certain set of unknowns, fears, whatever might be with me then working with that person, even though I know it's going to be fine. What would be some examples of like some self-talk or some things that maybe you would give me or somebody else in a similar situation in work, not necessarily in sports, that might be beneficial in scenarios like that?
Yeah, I would ask you, Brendan, what is it about meeting with that person for the first time? So what exactly is that fear? Because oftentimes we might think the situation is what's making us feel anxious, but it's our belief about that situation. Because again, me and you can be in the same situation of we're about to experience a new client and the way we're feeling could be completely different. And what sets us apart is our belief in that situation. So my first step would be to ask you, what are you fearful of? And then dependent upon what you come up with those beliefs or self-talk statements, we can work on countering them or reframing them in a way that would be more helpful for you.
That's awesome. I feel like that kind of creates a little bit of a framework in my own head of like that these thoughts or these feelings aren't necessarily kind of the end all be all too, mm-hmm. that they are kind of workable. And that there potentially might be some things or some ways that I could kind of look at the situation and be like, okay, yeah, I'm feeling these things and whatever it may be, but I could potentially, you know, work with someone or even work with my own mind if I really kind of put the time into it to move things in a different direction.
Yeah. And you're bringing up another good point of how automatic our sympathetic nervous system can be and can become activated. And sometimes, like you said, the thoughts aren't necessarily the end all be all, but if we're experiencing that immediate reaction of, okay, our heart rate just got a little faster, or just notice my muscles got a little more tense, we think that that's the end all be all, but really it's taking a step back from it to recognize what thoughts might be attached to those and then being able to work through that and recognizing that it wasn't necessarily the situation per se, but our perception of that situation.
That makes a lot of sense. So what are some other things? You've talked about a few things now. You know, there's breath work, there's maybe doing some self-talk. Are there any other things that you can think of that are more specific to actionable steps that would potentially improve your stress response or your way that you're kind of viewing it? And then potentially, what are some things that we might already do or coping mechanisms that potentially are negatively influencing our stress response and how we're handling our stress?
Yeah, good questions. So the first place I would like to start at is increasing your own awareness of the ways that you might feel stress. And when I say you, Brendan, I mean, I'm talking in general.
I got you. Yeah, Loki just turned this into a nice little mental performance consultant situation for myself.
So we might feel it physiologically with headaches, stomach pains, or muscle tension, or more mentally with disruption in our concentration, not being able to manage distractions, feeling really fatigued. And then our behaviors could end up being affected by this. So if we're really stressed out, we might resort to behaviors that we don't typically do day to day, like eating way too much, or smoking, or drinking, or not getting your physical activity. So ironically, those are all things that can help ease our stress and keep us healthy and help with our cardiovascular system. And when we're feeling stressed, we do those, or we might do those types of behaviors that are actually hurting us. So recognizing how our stress manifests itself in certain behaviors can be one step to increase your awareness and how to gain a little bit more control over that. And another thing that could be helpful is recognizing or in line with those behaviors, that might be the way that you're coping with those stressors. Mm. So our coping is us being able to change our thoughts and behaviors to adapt to certain situations. And I feel like sometimes we use the word coping and just think it's a good thing. Mm. Like, okay, use some coping skills, or how are you coping with that? And sometimes it can be these more unhealthy or unhelpful behaviors like the ones I mentioned.
Sure.
So even if it's not helpful, it's still part of this coping toolkit. So recognizing what's helping or hurting you. And we can break it down in a few different categories of coping. The first I want to mention is problem-focused. Problem-focused coping is the way to go when a situation that's causing you stress can be changed. For example, and maybe you could share a personal example after I share mine.
Yep.
I remember I was giving a talk at a conference that I had to fly to, and my flight was the same day as my presentation. Flying in the morning, presentation in the afternoon.
Oh boy.
Yeah. A few days before it, they were getting bad weather to where I was flying. So now I'm stressed out because my perception is I'm going to be late, I'm going to miss my talk, and now, you know, everything goes where it's going to go. I could have did two things. I could have problem solved. Can I change the situation? In that instance, it was either change my flight to the previous day, change the talk, couldn't change the talk, so that was out. Tried to change my flight, couldn't get out the day before. So now I cannot change the situation.
Mm.
Tried problem-focused coping, can't change the situation that's causing me stress. So then I needed to resort to emotion-focused coping. Emotion-focused coping is managing the feelings or emotions that you're having from whatever is causing you stress.
Sure.
So I was really anxious, high muscle tension. I did some breathing, progressive muscle relaxation, calming myself down for what's causing my stress. Now, sometimes we experience stressors that can be changed and we do emotion-focused coping. So yeah, you're making yourself feel better, but it's temporary because you didn't actually address the problem that's causing you stress. So it could be really helpful to identify if a situation can be changed, if it can do some problem-focused coping in addition to emotion-focused. But with problem-focused, you are managing or changing the problem. So this could be through goal setting, communication, delegating tasks to help lessen that stress. And then emotion-focused coping, doing certain things to manage your emotions. And then I say all this, but my main coping mechanism is avoidant, which is just avoid what's causing you stress. And then, of course, you're not changing the problem and you're just temporarily making yourself feel better. So I'm very aware that I'm more avoidant. And being aware of that and which type of coping mechanism or what category it falls into could be really helpful in dealing with that stress.
That really makes a lot of sense. And it's cool to have a framework to be able to break those down, those coping mechanisms down into three different components, opposed to just lumping it into like, yeah, I just have this coping mechanism and I don't even know what it is. I just do my thing and it's all automatic.
Mm-hmm.
So knowing that there could potentially be a space between the stress itself and then your reaction to it.
Yes.
Or that coping mechanism. So one thing that when you were telling me about all these different potential coping mechanisms is I feel like sometimes my reaction to a stress is so involuntary that I think I don't even have the capability to create that space between the stress itself and then my response itself to be able to then even be have the mental awareness to recognize that's problem focused,
mm-hmm.
that's emotional focused, that's just avoidance. Do you have any tools or tricks in order to be able to create that space between that stressful moment or to be better able at recognizing some of these different patterns over a longer period of time to potentially grow your capacity for improving your stress response?
Mm-hmm. Thanks for mentioning that, Brendan. So with awareness being the big step, because if you're not even aware that you're doing it, you can't change it.
Sure.
One way to do this could be to reflect on a day that's stressful. Like, let me ask you this. After a long day or even the next day, are you able to be like, wow, yesterday was stressful, or wow, I experienced some stress yesterday. You're able to
big time. Yeah.
Yeah. So when that happens, you can reflect on what went down that day, what your responses to those particular situations were, and then that middle space of it. What about that situation was so stressful or contributed to that stress? And then looking at the behaviors, that could be, how did you handle it? Did it help with the stress? Did it make it worse? So being able to reflect can help with that awareness to then notice whether there are patterns with what you're experiencing. And then once you increase that more, you're able to sort of catch it as it's happening. And then that's where that practice comes in.
Okay, that makes sense. So do you have a recommendation for a reflection process at the end of the day? So for example, like would this take the form of journaling? Would this take the form of, hey, at the end of the day, before I go to bed, I'm just going to take the time, maybe it's 2 minutes, maybe it's 1 minute, to just do this reflection in order to try to understand how I was responding in this specific day? How would you actionably put this into play?
Sure. So it's going to look different for everybody. Everybody might have things that they're already doing that works for them in terms of a reflection on a day, even if it's not specific to this. For example, maybe people jot down notes after a meeting. Mm-hmm. That could be, if they're already doing that, that could be a good time to reflect on what their stress was like as part of that. Or maybe people talk with their partner at the end of the day and talk things out. That could be another time to do it. Journaling has shown benefits to helping with these sorts of things and increasing awareness, increasing gratitude. It also can externalize a lot of the thoughts that we're having. So getting it out, pen and paper, writing it down can help externalize some of those thoughts.
Sure. Yeah.
So I suppose I would say to acknowledge what you might be doing throughout a day already in terms of reflection or something of that sort, and then being able to input some of this into that daily routine could be, I suppose, an easier way to kind of kick things off instead of trying a brand new behavior of, let's say, journaling or something like that.
Sure. That makes sense.
Yeah. And with everything I'm mentioning in terms of ways we manage stress and can try and relieve this stress, I'd like to hear a bit from you from the exercise and physical activity side of things on how that could be beneficial and play a role into our stress.
Yeah, definitely. So I think it's important to break exercise down into a few different groupings in order to potentially be able to understand how each of those potentially impacts it.
For sure. That sounds good.
We, as an overall general statement, a lot of times most exercise will have some sort of cascade events where it'll produce some sort of endorphins, which then potentially lead to some sort of physiological response, like the elevated heart rate, like an elevated blood pressure. And then by doing that exercise, we become better and better at being able to have our mind and body interpret that physiological response as not something that's bad, but something that we can work through. Mm-hmm. And we can get better and better at decreasing our heart rate after we've done that, that exercise. And through improving our cardiovascular fitness by doing said exercise, then we're also improving our ability to respond to stress.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, this ability to manage our heart rate could be very beneficial for us. And one way with that is through exercise and then being able to decrease it and increase it at certain times.
Yeah. So there's basically you're improving your physiological response to the elevated heart rate that you might also experience when you're in a stressful experience and things like that. And then coupled with just endorphins, which end up just naturally being mood boosters and kind of like brain candy to be able to just function through life with a little bit more optimism, happiness, things like that.
Awesome. Thanks.
Yeah. And then with that being said, I think it's important to then know how different types of exercise will influence. So for example, HIIT training or more high intensity training, you're going to get a much greater physiological response. So it's important to note that if that response is too high, then it might also act in a negative way. So if your cortisol levels, so that's basically one of the kind of antithesis to that endorphin production, the cortisol is that high stress response. If that's still high and you still haven't had adequate time to cool down from that and you're going into, a meeting in the next second, you might still be in that elevated state before you're going into the next kind of stressful moment of your life and you haven't fully recovered from that. So there are certain situations where it's important to be mindful of the timing of your exercise. So if you have a really important meeting for whatever it may be, doing maybe more of a yoga or something that's a little bit lower intensity prior to that meeting may end up allowing you to still get a little bit of blood flow and a little bit of things moving in a positive direction, but you're not going into the meeting at an already elevated state.
I think that is incredibly important information to be aware of, especially when it comes down to people scheduling their exercise dependent on what time they have available and free. So even if it might not be the best thing to do a HIIT workout before a big meeting due to the increase in your cortisol levels or your heart rate, that might be the only time that someone has to do it. So it seems like it could be helpful for them to recognize how they're feeling before that meeting or working on ways to sort of lower that heart rate or those cortisol levels before going into the meeting. Interesting.
Definitely. And I will say too, everyone's response to those types of workouts is different. So if you're an incredibly highly trained athlete and you're doing a HIIT workout and you also have 5 minutes to do, whether it's some diaphragmatic breathing or like, a cool down where you can stretch for 5 minutes, then you might be able to bring that heart rate down and you might be able to bring that cortisol response down very quickly. And you might, actually still feel energized going into that meeting as a result of it. So I was saying that with just to give an example, but it might not be the same for everyone based off of their current level of fitness and things along those lines.
Yeah. And their perception of what that meeting is. If we're going back to
exactly
how you view meetings.
Yeah.
And I think the example that you gave though is really helpful because it also seems like a good opportunity to practice these sorts of techniques after doing something so beneficial like exercise and then working on the mental performance before then going into your next task.
Totally. Yeah.
And Brendan, sticking with the timing of exercise. So if we were to think about our sleep and how helpful that could be for immune system functioning and consolidating memories and overall recovery, what about how exercise might affect us before bedtime or before we're planning to go to sleep? Could you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, good question. So typically the rule of thumb is you don't want to be doing at least a higher intensity exercise within 1 to 2 hours, depending on kind of which research study that you're looking at, but in very, very close proximity. That allows you to then adjust your circadian rhythm so that you're able to downregulate enough before you actually fall into your sleep pattern. So ideally 1 to 2 hours before is probably the last timing that you want to do your especially a higher intensity workout.
Mm-hmm. And higher intensity workouts will vary for each individual too, right?
Very much so. Mm-hmm. Yep. But as an overarching theme, just 1 to 2 hours, if you can give it a little bit of space. And also for some people, it's like, okay, well, that's the only time that you have. And so that's where more of your being able to find ways to then still downregulate despite having already done that high intensity exercise. So whether it's meditation, whether it's breath work, whether it's just a prolonged stretching to make sure that you're not in this state of high, high cortisol, high, high heart rate, and then immediately just trying to fold up underneath the covers and go to bed. So there are definitely some tips and tricks that you can still do if that's the only way that you can exercise. But as a general theme, if you can program your workouts to being a little bit earlier in the day and timed appropriately to allow cortisol to decrease before an important business meeting or whatever it is.
Sure. And sticking with that down regulating, decreasing cortisol, overall stress levels, trying to activate that parasympathetic nervous system, hoping you could talk about things like you've mentioned, like with mindfulness, meditation, breath work, and give us some insight into that.
Yeah, definitely. So I think you hit the nail on the head when you talked about the parasympathetic nervous system. I feel like so many of these different activities are geared towards ways that you can influence that exact neurological pathway is basically either mindfully bringing your body into a state of a little bit more equilibrium where you're in that parasympathetic state, or with breath work, it's actually even more of just a true physiological response and not even something that you need to be doing with high levels of cognitive activity. It's just your going through those physiological concepts and still getting that potential parasympathetic activation.
Yeah.
Which is why I tend to like recommending breath work for people that really have potentially pretty busy schedule, or they might only be able to fit it in while they're doing something else, even. Sure. Is because you can still, with something like a cyclic sigh or some of the other box work or box breathing, things like that, you can still get the parasympathetic response even while you're, walking to work or whatever it may be. Granted, you want to be doing something like this in a space, at least initially, where it's a more controlled environment so you can get the hang of it and things like that. But once it becomes more second nature, you can potentially, I have somebody that is a orthopedic surgeon, and she does breath work while she scrubs in. So it's something that you can do kind of while you're almost habit stacking.
Yes.
And then mindfulness meditation, which is probably the most common meditation practice and most highly researched. That's where you're taking the time to really take a step back and sit by yourself for, 5 to 10 minutes, depending on your own practice, and being able to be a little bit more focused on one individual intention, whether it be your breath, or there's kind of some other different things that we can go into to try to get a sense of what your ideal anchor point should be.
Mm-hmm.
But this is more oriented around trying to create a higher level of focus and simplicity, and allowing you to then just come out of that higher cortisol state and really focus on one specific thing at a time. And that actually made me think a little bit on just the stress response as a whole. When we were talking about, you have that stressful moment, then there's a space, and then there's your reaction.
Mm-hmm.
I think mindfulness meditation does a really nice job making you more and more aware of that potential space. Creating that awareness that there is something else that could potentially happen in that response stage, opposed to just going right into your more automatic kind of coping mechanisms that you were chatting about earlier.
Yeah, for sure. And even staying on the lines of mindfulness, when also recognizing the component of this non-judgmental awareness to the present moment, when, if you're speaking of automatic responses, we can so quickly judge ourselves for a certain type of way that we're feeling or a certain situation that we're in. So like you said, it fits nicely in that space between the perception and then the ultimate behavior performance we might experience.
Yeah, totally.
So with that mindfulness and meditation, Brendan, I'd like to bring us back to something that you mentioned in different types of breathing and breath work. And I think there are some myths or associations that a lot of us tend to have around breath work. And I'm hoping you could debunk some of that and give us some insight into what different types of breath work actually are.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head when you said myths. I feel like a lot of people, they see Wim Hof and they kind of picture that breath work is essentially just getting into this weird zone where you're able to do superhuman feats. But we've reached this awesome time where there's a lot of research now that are backing up some of these different habits that then have true physiological responses that we can really influence towards our benefit. So I think breaking down things into two different concepts: breath work that potentially upregulates you, and changes things via the carbon dioxide to oxygen ratio that creates a more of an upregulation or an increased heart rate.
Yep.
That would be your Wim Hof, actually. So the reasons that he's able to be in these really cold states is because he has the elevated heart rate from this Wim Hof mechanism, which he goes into hypocapnia, which is where you're in more of an elevated carbon dioxide state for a prolonged period of time, and then in a cyclic way. And then conversely, your cyclic sigh and your box breathing, these are going to be things that downregulate you.
Mm-hmm.
So cyclic sigh has been the most heavily researched breath work that within 5 minutes you can decrease your stress, and actually even greater than meditation, can hold that stress reduction or that impact on your parasympathetic state for a longer period of time than most meditations and most breath works. So if our goal is stress reduction, mm-hmm. our cyclic sigh is probably our best practice that you could potentially influence if you only have 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So your cyclic sigh is basically taking a relatively long in-breath and then a short in-breath and then a long exhale. So if you can hear me in this podcast, it would basically look like you're taking a short in-breath and then, you can't really hear.
I'll do it as you talk. Okay.
Yes, you do a short in-breath and then a quick in-breath and then a long exhale and then repeat that cycle for 5 minutes. The really, really, really long exhale is probably the most important part of that, and it mimics a lot of the other types of breathwork styles.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, there's box breathing. There's also 4-6-7 breathing. It's basically focusing on doing a longer exhale and a slightly shorter in-breath.
Mm-hmm.
Box breathing is slightly different because it allows you to go into basically just breaking up your breathing pattern normality. And allows you to then focus on recognizing some of that space in between your breaths and creates that pH balance once again of creating that equilibrium of same amount of in-breath, same amount of exhale.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times when we're really stressed, we're in more of a much more inspiration state where we have all these more in-breaths than out-breaths, or our in-breath is longer than our exhale. So the down regulators, so the cyclic sigh and the box breathing, bring us out of that, and the Wim Hof is kind of the opposite. It kind of brings us into that more upregulated state where you have that high heart rate, things like that.
Mm-hmm. And just to elaborate a little bit on the box breathing. So let's say we're breaking up the inhale and the exhale and adding that pause. It would look like an inhale for 4 beats, then we hold for 4 beats, then we exhale for 4 beats, and then we hold for 4 beats, and then we repeat it. So really breaking up the inhale with the exhale. And Brendan, you also bring up a good point about how different types of breathing can be useful depending on what someone might need. And I just need to plug in my athletes again, because it's also such a good example of how depending on what they need in certain times when it comes to their activation levels and what's best for their performance, if they need to up-regulate or down-regulate themselves. So thanks for mentioning that.
Of course, yeah. One other thing too about box breathing is it is sometimes there's a way that you can actually assess to determine your carbon dioxide expiration rate. So in order to best understand how long you would need to hold each of those different pieces of that box, so you could potentially do a test in order to determine if you are a 3-second hold, mm-hmm. and then 3-second expiration, then 3-second hold, then 3-second inspiration, or if that number should be 4 or 5 or 6 or things like that. But I think one really simple kind of actionable thing would be try it, and then if it's too hard to hold for that long, then go shorter. If it's too easy, you could probably hold for slightly longer durations, and you'll notice that your ability to perform the box breathing might improve over, you know, the first month that you try it potentially too.
Yeah. All of this stuff being things that take practice and to put the work in to see how it could best benefit an individual.
Totally.
So I hope that Brendan and I were helpful in shedding some light behind some of the science and how stress can interact with our cardiovascular system, and also provide some insight into how you can apply this to your own context in order to better manage or have some more control over your stress, given that sometimes it can feel like it controls us, and then how that affects our overall well-being. So thank you all for listening.
Thanks, everyone. This was fun.